versus Rubio. Petitioner may proceed.
May it please the court, I'm Patricia Van Horn, registration number 30,002, and I represent the people in this matter. This case involves the trial court's failure to give the jury an instruction on a lesser non-included offense. The defendant fired an AK-47 at a house of a person who had disparaged his gang, and the shots hit two neighboring houses. One house contained a woman and her three children. The other house contained two adults. The shots seriously injured two of the women's children, two of the girls, and the adult in the other house sustained minor injuries. The defendant was charged with six counts of attempted extreme indifference murder. He was also charged with illegal discharge of a firearm. Before jury selection, the trial court granted the prosecution's request to dismiss the illegal discharge of a firearm count, and the defendant did not object to that. At the close of evidence, the defendant requested that the jury receive an instruction on illegal discharge of a firearm, and the trial court denied that request. The Court of Appeals determined that this was error, and it was harmless as to the two counts relating to the two young girls who received serious bodily injury. And they determined it was reversible error as to the other three counts. Although this case presents the issues of whether the defendant was entitled to the lesser non-included offense instruction under existing law, and whether, if so, whether it was harmless, the issue I would like to focus on today is whether Colorado should overrule Rivera and hold that a defendant is not entitled to instructions on a lesser non-included offense.
It's a pretty big escalation, isn't it? I mean, isn't the basic argument here is that the evidence didn't require or support giving the non-lesser included? You're asking us to reach a much broader issue?
Yes,
why should we do that?
Why should we do it? The federal courts don't do it at all. The majority of other states don't do it at all.
Oh, well, initially, before you argue the merits, why should we address that when we didn't grant cert on that, when we've addressed it recently? I mean, I think that's the preliminary question, is should we even go there to reevaluate this on the merits?
I think it's encompassed within the cert issue when we look at whether the trial court erred in failing to allow the defendant to proceed with that instruction. It's not an argument that I could have made to the Court of Appeals in that they did not have the authority to overrule Rivera. So back to that argument, unlike lesser included offenses, lesser non-included offenses are not required by any rule, any statute, and it's an entirely a court-created concept. Which has been roundly criticized by courts across the country. The Supreme Court and the majority of state courts have rejected that a defendant is entitled to a lesser non-included offense for numerous reasons. And the first is it undermines the prosecution's charging authority because it gives the defendant the power to determine what he is charged with. It can result in unfair surprise because the parties will have been focusing on the elements, proving and raising doubt as to the elements of the charged offenses, and any included offenses, of course, would be part of that. It gives the defendant a superior trial right because in most cases, and Garcia is an exception here because of the odd circumstances with the charging document, the prosecution is prevented from seeking an instruction on a lesser non-included offense because of notice requirements. And unlike included offenses, there's very little guidance for trial courts to determine when one is necessary and when one is not. Also, we recognize if the state's evidence is insufficient on one of the charged offenses, the jury will not convict the defendant. And if the jury does convict the defendant, the court can set aside that verdict if there was, in fact, insufficient evidence. Courts have also recognized that it confuses the jury process rather than helps it with the additional instructions and prolonging the instructions, adding to the number of issues the jury has to consider, and increasing the possibility for jury confusion and compromised verdicts. And finally, I'd like to point out the people are not asserting that the prosecution should have this right, but the defendant shouldn't. The people are asserting that these instructions should not be given. I think there could be an exception made if the prosecution and the defense agree that it's appropriate under the circumstances of a particular case, but we are not asserting that the prosecution...
What would be the rationale for that? I mean, there seems to be a rationale which you haven't gotten into for why we do these instructions to begin with. What would be the rationale for allowing it by stipulation other than the fact that if everybody agrees that they should be able to do what they want? I mean,
I don't know,
why would we do it?
I don't necessarily pursuant to your rationale. I don't think you should do it at all, but I can see where that might be a possibility.
All right.
I don't think we should do it that way, but I can see based on unusual circumstances where that might not be automatic error or an automatic problem if both sides agree under the unique circumstances of our case, we both want this.
Unique circumstances.
I don't know. I'm just saying I don't think either side is entitled to them. Is my major point.
Is the rationale right now why the prosecutor, even though he's the charging authority, is not entitled to it, is because the defendant hasn't been given sufficient notice of it?
Correct.
If the defendant waives any objection to the lack of notice, would there be an objection to adding that charge at that point in time?
If the prosecution wants that, I think that would be... comparable to what
does
I'm
that
saying,
amount to a stipulation?
Where they stipulate that it would be appropriate under the circumstances. I honestly don't envision a circumstance where that would happen, where the prosecution and the defense would agree to that, but I can see where that might be a possibility.
Van Horn, are you finished with that topic?
Question.
Okay. In your brief, that I'm not asking you about lesser non include that specifically, elimination of that doctrine. What I wanted to ask you is I simply don't understand the second point that you make on the facts in this case. Just explain it to me. Where you say that basically, or that if assuming for purpose of argument there's a rational basis for the jury to convict the defendant of illegal discharge of firearm and acquit him of the attempted extreme indifference murder, the error was harmless. And I just don't quite understand your reasoning. It's the explanation for it, I guess. So maybe you could just elaborate on that.
What the defendant did was pull out an AK-47 and start firing.
Do we know how many rounds he fired or anything like that?
I don't recall. I from what I remember, it was just a thing. It was an automatic weapon. And the jury found that he acted knowingly and
reversal malice.
Right. And so having found that, and it was the same, of course, it's happenstance where the bullets land, I think it's harmless.
So you're treating the shooting the AK-47 as one specific act and not differentiating, even though in fact I guess two people were seriously injured and others were not, and one the guy was acquitted.
A minor injury, right. Because they already found that he had that mental state.
But what's the basis for saying that it didn't matter, assuming that because a legal discharge of a firearm was in a dwelling, as I understand, so it's not like, you know, not a misdemeanor, but, you know, city ordinance violation where someone's shooting it up in the air or something like that. So what, I just am having a hard time understanding why that wouldn't be important if, as at least I understand it, the argument was that I was reckless, you know, the defense was I was reckless here. I meant to hit the car and instead, you know, some of the bullets hit the houses.
I just think by finding that he had this mental state as to the as by finding that he had this mental state, that's what the jury found, the action was one and the same action, that he didn't have, it was not merely recklessness by convicting him of these counts and simultaneously convicting him as to the two girls that were seriously injured.
What would be the basis for distinguishing, for giving the nine lesser included to the two of the counts and not all five of them, from a trial judge's perspective?
Those were the, I assume, because those were the counts where the people actually sustained serious bodily injury, as opposed to...
What difference would that make in terms of the one act and whether or not the person acted recklessly? I think both crimes require knowingly, so we're really talking about recklessly versus universal malice. So why would there be a differentiation there? Or what's the rational evidentiary basis for it, really?
With the trial courts having given that?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me if I were the trial judge, I accept your argument, then I'd give it to them all, or I wouldn't give it to any of them. The one act business. And I'm just confused by it. I don't know what to make of this, to be honest with you.
And I think part of the problem with this case is that the discussion regarding these instructions was off the record. And so all we have is, and it's clear from what we do have, that they had a lengthy discussion about the instructions and why they wanted specific instructions, why the court was or was not going to give these specific instructions off the record. So then all we have on the record is the very brief, the prosecution chose to dismiss this, so I'm not going to instruct on it. So I don't know the rationale in this case.
Thank you.
That's all I can say about that.
So just phrase for me again, what is the legal standard for a judge to consider, assuming we don't reverse our prior case or set it aside, giving a lesser non-included offense? What's the standard?
What's the standard for giving a lesser non-included offense?
Right.
It has to be, there has to be evidence to support that offense, and there has to be a rational basis, it's the same as the lesser included, for the jury to convict of the lesser and acquit of the greater.
And what do you think the greater means? Is it only a greater that's charged, or is it any greater offense that's clearly established by the evidence?
I don't know the answer to that. I just see so many problems with these cases because it's a very difficult thing, and I think other courts have recognized it, rather than having a nice clean test where you can see we have elements, are they here? Is this lesser charge included within these elements? And is there evidence to support it, instead of having to go through an entire record to see if there was evidence for, and for the trial court to remember whether there was evidence presented that could go to this lesser non-included offense?
I guess part of what I was trying to get at, and it's sort of peripherally related to the question whether you treat these as separate counts and lessers going to only those counts, or this is somehow a unified thing. If the defendant, in this case, we're arguing about discharge of a weapon, but let's assume he asked for a lesser of jaywalking, and there was evidence to support that. If the evidence showed clearly that he at least committed discharging of a weapon, which is greater than jaywalking, would he be entitled to skip intermediate offenses and ask for, in effect, a lesser, as long as there's some evidence to support it? Or does there have to be evidence to acquit of intermediate crimes, even though he was not charged with them, but they were clearly established?
I haven't seen any law on that, and I was actually thinking in this case of offenses the defendant could have requested, non-included offenses, and how ridiculous that could get at some points, and why you would even allow that. And I think going back to this idea of just because there is evidence there, we don't necessarily charge all those offenses. The law with this in Colorado, there have been so many problems with it, with the standard of review and what somebody thinks is the rational basis and what somebody doesn't, and whether there's actual evidence of that or whether it's just an inference from the evidence. And that's why I think the court should rule of
I'm having trouble with the doctrine too, but I didn't practice in this area, but it seems to me it's sort of a safety valve for the judge after hearing all the evidence to see whether or not the evidence is equivocal enough to allow or in his or her discretion. That's why I'm going to phrase it. I'm not saying that's what the case says. Put a charge in there that is not there that the jury could consider, but certainly not anything that's dreamed up in the face of facts like this.
And I see it all the time, but I'd just like to quickly point out the evidence here wasn't just the person who discharged a weapon. It was the person who deliberately went over to that house to shoot it up. He called afterwards and said, I shot up your house. This isn't just some random...
That's what I was referring to. The overwhelming evidence that this is anything but reckless discharge on the 4th of July of a firearm.
Correct. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Malofsky. Tom Carberry appearing for Mr. Rubio as an alternate defense counsel. Mr. Rubio went to trial based on over 30 years of precedent by this court in the Rivera case. One thing that the Rivera case actually decided two very important Colorado doctrines. First, Rivera held that Colorado would follow the strict elements test to determine what is a lesser included or non-included offense. And they did it on the grounds that the strict element test provides notice to the defendant, in other words, protects the defendant's constitutional rights. Then the Rivera court went on and asked the question, if it is the strict elements test, does it preclude the defendant from receiving a non-included offense instruction? And there the court held that, again, in order to protect the defendant's right to a jury trial and the reality of the case, that they were going to allow the defendant to put himself at risk for a conviction that wasn't charged in order to get convicted of a lesser offense. The United States Supreme Court has discussed this also in a lesser included context, and in the case of Beck against Alabama, the United States Court essentially held that the defendant should be allowed to have a lesser included offense in order to keep the jury from convicting him of a greater offense just because they want to convict him of something. And that's the essential problem in this case. This case has some bad facts, but if you look at the exhibits in this case, it's clear that Mr. Rubio shot at this Chevy Blazer. He destroyed this Chevy Blazer. And these are little houses, and this doesn't come out very well in the trial. The trial was done poorly, and so the facts are hard to see, but these are very little houses close together. And a couple of bullets or bullet fragments went into the houses of the Ancios and of the Vencers. And of course struck these two little girls and seriously injured these two little girls, which creates a very giant emotional problem. But you have to remember that the case went to trial charged not just as attempted murder, but with illegal discharge of a firearm and criminal mischief. Those were the charges till the day of trial. And that's because there was a rational basis for those, because the prosecutors wouldn't charge these counts if they didn't have this rational basis. They went to trial, and the jury, despite the fact that Mr. Rubio didn't get these lesser offenses instructions, the jury still found him not guilty of the shooting in the house of Patricia Balbueno, whereas her husband, Mr. Anzo, the jury found Mr. Rubio guilty of attempted extreme indifference murder against him. He was the man who got a slight cut on his head, and we're not sure exactly what, nobody's sure what it did. It was either a piece of glass or a piece of plaster or a piece of wood. Nobody's really sure, but he got a cut. So it's very important to see that this is not a clear-cut case factually. The jury found him not guilty of an offense. We also have to remember that the whole concept of lesser included and non-included instructions is a semantic construction by the courts. The court in this court in Rivera had to decide between the strict elements test and what they called the evidentiary test, and other courts have called the cognate evidence test. But whatever the test is, what the court in Rivera said is that when you go to trial, oftentimes the jury, it's apparent that the defendant committed some crime, that the question is what crime. And here, the question presented to the jury was, what did Mr. Rubio himself commit? And that's what defense counsel wanted to present to the jury. He committed illegal discharge of a firearm. And as the Court of Appeals pointed out, he did get a lesser non-included instruction of second degree assault reckless. That is a non-included instruction because it requires a firearm, whereas this case attempted extreme indifference murder doesn't require anything. So he got instruction there, and the jury found him guilty of the two girls because they were seriously injured. The little boy, the little brother, wasn't injured at all, but the jury found Mr. Rubio guilty of attempted extreme indifference murder there, too. And you have to remember, jurors are human beings. These are emotional facts. You can't go to trial on a case like this with two little girls who are seriously injured and expect to walk out free. The question is, what are you going to be convicted of?
Mr. Carberry, why should we affirm the Court of Appeals' opinion?
Well, because the Court of Appeals is correct.
Why?
There was a rational basis to give the lesser non-included offense instructions on the non-injured persons. And just as the Court of Appeals have pointed out, they said it was harmless in the case of the injured girls because they did get lessers. But the non-injured people, this is classic illegal discharge of a firearm facts. These are exactly what these...
So it's illegal discharge of a firearm in dwelling, isn't it?
And there are two ways to do it. It could be an occupied car, which we don't have here, because the car itself was, that's just criminal mischief with the car. And here, it doesn't have to be an occupied dwelling. It has to be a dwelling or an occupied structure, which are statutorily different definitions.
What about Ms. Van Horn's argument about, one act?
I don't think that's true. What happened really is if you listen, the various witnesses and that testified in the trial testified about a variety of shots that they heard, different neighbors. Some people said they heard four shots. Some people heard they had heard five or six. And I think the most anybody said they heard was seven shots. So this isn't a burst of machine gun fire. This is separate shots fired into this car. And what we think happened, because nobody actually knows, is that fragments of the bullets, or possibly of the car, ricocheted into this other house. And there we have Mr. Rubio, who admittedly did seriously injure two people, but got 180 years. And even with the Court of Appeals decision, it reduces his sentence to 72 years, which with the three-quarter rule since 2004 for crimes of violence means he's not even eligible for parole for three quarters of that. So we're looking at a man that's serving a life sentence in prison. And the reality of it is that there's a dichotomy in this lesser non-included instructions. We have two different doctrines. We have a theory of the case doctrine that nobody doubts. The U.S. Supreme Court and the Colorado Supreme Court were all on board on this, that a defendant has a constitutional right to present a theory of the case.
Answer your question about that. That reminds me of something that bothered me. Did the defense lawyer in this case ask for a theory of defense instruction with respect to the illegal discharge of a firearm?
Judge, I do not believe that he did.
That's off the record.
That's a separate issue. That's a 35C issue for later. This is a lawyer who had just gotten out of federal prison for 10 years of selling cocaine before he did this trial. So, that's a totally different issue that I'm not raising here at this level at all. But the dichotomy between the theory of the case instruction and the lesser non-included doctrine is this. If I tell the jury my client is not guilty of attempted extreme indifference murder, he's only guilty of illegal discharge of a firearm, but we're not going to instruct you on illegal discharge of a firearm, and we're not going to give you the option of a verdict to find him guilty of that. Your only option is to find him not guilty. That's an option that the jury can't accept, because human beings can't accept the fact that a person could shoot a gun in a neighborhood and endanger a bunch of people and not be convicted of anything.
Can I take you back to your discussion of the Rivera case, please? Yes. And you were talking, I think, about trying to develop the ideas of the differences between a lesser included and a lesser non-included. Could you go into that?
In Rivera, the court said that various jurisdictions had discussed different ways to determine whether a charge was lesser included or non-included. And this court in Rivera said, well, some courts have done the strict element test, and they don't mention Blockberger, they just talked about the strict elements. And then other courts have developed an evidentiary test, whereas after hearing the evidence, if the lesser count is part of the evidence, then you should get that instruction. And that's sort of a discussion of the rational basis test. But the court did two things. First, it said, well, the defendant has a right to notice of what the charges are against him, and for that reason, we're going to adopt a strict element test to protect the defendant. That was the reason this court adopted the strict element test, so the defendant would have notice. And then this court said, but does that preclude giving a lesser non-included at the request of the defendant? And in Rivera, they said, no, it does not. It does preclude the prosecution because of the notice problem. And that specifically was held in Rivera. And then, but the defendant could get it because the defendant can put himself at risk for being convicted of a crime not charged.
Well, I'd like to explore a little bit the first part, though, where you're talking about adopting the strict elements test and compare that to Mr. Van Horn's argument about how Colorado stands in a small minority of jurisdictions with respect to the position we have taken on this lesser non-included. Do we know anything about all those other jurisdictions in terms of whether they adopt the strict elements test or whether they use the rational basis test?
I have not done all 50 states, but we do know that some states adopt the strict elements test. For instance, California used to have the evidentiary test, and they, I think in 1998, they switched to the strict elements test and rejected our doctrine of the lesser non-included based on the evidentiary test. But on the same, you know, when we're talking about Colorado being in some minority, we're not sure what level of minority, we do know that the counts that Mr. Rubio was convicted of, attempted extreme indifference murder, is in a minority of one, because this is the only state that recognizes that doctrine. So, you know, adopting things just because everybody else goes along with it is not really, I think, the most rational.
Mr. Carberry, your point seems to be, and I'm just not quite sure I understand the reason for it, but seems to be that the lesser not included doctrine is compatible with and makes sense with a strict elements test, and is but not so much with the rational basis test. Is that correct?
It obviously doesn't fit the strict elements test, but what it does is it fits the defendant's constitutional right to prevent a theory presented.
Well, you're saying the doctrine is an appropriate companion to the strict elements test, whereas if you have the rational basis test, it is not necessary to have the lesser not included doctrine. Is that correct?
No, I don't think.
Help me
out
here.
I think they're both the same standard. You must have the same standard. You have to have rational basis in the evidence to receive the lesser instruction. If you have the rational basis to have this lesser included or non-included instruction, from the defendant's point of view, it doesn't make sense constitutionally for the defendant's rights to disallow it, because it gives the jury only one option: convict of the attempted murder count, the class 2 felony, and not be allowed to convict of the legislatively declared count of illegal discharge of a firearm. That is a, you know, that was a statute sought for and by the district attorney's counsel and provided by the legislature for precisely this type of case. That's exactly, you know, I've quoted John Southers in that in my brief, and that's precisely what he said. If a bullet went into a house and barely missed somebody's head, we need illegal discharge of a firearm. And since then, the prosecutions have learned that they can charge attempted extreme indifference murder.
Well, I don't think he was talking about evidence has to do with the gang activity where they're going to go shoot up a house and with people likely to be in it. I mean, I just can't believe that was the legislature's intent in adopting this statute that you just mentioned, but or this offense.
That's
I think it's the 4th of July kind of thing where you're shooting at arcs and hit somebody.
But that's okay.
What you were going to send us the legislative intent on this other crime?
Well, I put in my briefs that I have the CD-ROM of the legislative history, you know, with the actual discussion with everybody's, and I could provide the court with that. And that's exactly what the district attorney's counsel asked for. John Suthers, who was district attorney of Colorado Springs back then, actually testified that we have no charge that we can charge somebody, no felony charge that we can charge somebody when they shoot into a house and barely miss somebody. That's exactly why they asked for that, Justice Hobbs. And with that,
One explanation to that might be that Mr. Suthers wasn't aware that we were an outlier of one about the attempt. You know, the intent requires an intent, and depraved heart murder or reckless is universal malice is a little inconsistent with that.
Thank you very much. And I'd ask this court to affirm the Court of Appeals and allow this case to be remanded to the Denver District Court. Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank both parties for their arguments. Case stands submitted.